Things we can all do to live a better life if times get tough or even if they don't. Today is Thursday, August the 20th, 2026, and this is episode 3886 of the Survival Podcast. And as a Thursday show, we have an expert panel Q&A for the week. I had a big piker problem with the expert panel, and this is August. August is piker season, and it's not really piker season. What it is everybody's busy. August is a very busy time of year. It's the end of summer. It's hot. People take vacations. Younger members have people going back to school, things like that. Everything is slower in August. I accept it. But I shook with all my might the tree of the pikers, and they fell abundantly to the ground. And I have plenty of content today, and I have almost enough content for next week as well, which is important since I will be traveling next week and need to get some things wrapped up early due to that. So I have given a few more tiny shakes to the Tree of Pikers for those who did not provide content and said, please, if I could get just a couple more segments this weekend, I can get the expert panel show done over the weekend for next week. And that will make leaving here a little easier. So if you are a panel member, council member, and you didn't receive the second email, and you don't see yourself on today's show or hear yourself, it's okay. You did nothing wrong. I just have kept some ammo in reserve for next week. If you didn't send me anything yet, please do, because I need some things. And I need help from you, the audience, as well. I need questions for the expert panel. You can find out all about our expert panel under the About tab at thesurvivalpodcast.com. See everybody there and what they do. Or if you really don't know who you want your question to go to, but you have a question that you know is the kind of stuff we cover, you can just say, pick one for me, and I'll do it. Right? I like when you guys tell me who you want to hear from, but I can figure it out. We have enough depth and breadth to cover almost anything on the show here with you. And if they can't do it, then maybe I will do it for you. So what do we got this week? Dr. Paul and Dan McAdams with the Ron Paul Liberty highlight of the week. I changed their title. I think this is a better title. Has President Trump fully divorced his relationship with reality? I'm starting to feel that way about the guy, and I'm not a Trump fan, but I'm not a Trump hater. I'm not full-on MAGA. I'm also not one of these people with TDS. And I try to be fair and even-handed. I try to be fair and even-handed with Bush, because that's who was president when I became a podcaster. And I tried to be fair and even-handed with Obama, because he was very soon thereafter our president, based on my predictions as well. And I would have try to be fair and even-handed with Biden, but there was no Biden. There was an empty suit and a retard show going on. It was like the inverse Truman Show or something. I don't like, we were all captive and he was free. We were wandering around being an idiot. But if I had been here, you know, back when Clinton was president, I would have been tried to be fair and even-handed. But we're getting into a place now. I have to agree with him. The guy doesn't seem like he cares about reality at all. And yes, he's trolling, but it doesn't matter, because there's a point where you have to grow up and realize you're the effing president of the United States, dude. Anyway, moving on. We're also having Nicole Sauce talk about a few big mistakes to avoid when trying to build community. Great segment there. Jesse Markowitz, the dangers of someone gaining access to your email. This was an overhyped, fear-based, clickbait bullshit that got the question asked, but the question's still valid. And Jesse does a great job. Andy McCann will talk about lifting weights being useful for weight loss, but also how diet impacts it no matter what. Like, and I love the way Andy covers this, because when you say, what exercises can I do to lose weight? I got a really simple exercise for you. Close the effing refrigerator door and don't eat the food, right? And there's better diets and all, and everything. You go carnivore, keto, paleo, primal, I don't care what. Like, get rid of all the processes. So all that's good. But in the end, the more you put in, the more the ass grows. That's just reality. But lifting weights can help you be able to eat a little bit more and still lose weight. And I haven't heard his whole segment yet. Just listen to the beginning of it. But I'm going to tell you what I think the number one exercise for losing weight is, and it is a weight-bearing exercise. And it's one that I think most people do not understand is really one of the most calorically burning things that you can do it. And that's why it works. John Pugliano will answer a very interesting question. This dude has a Roth IRA, a bunch of money in it. Wants to know, should I take some money out, pay off a house, or should I leave the money in and buy myself a Bitcoin? I have a little addition to John's excellent answer because I did listen to that already. Chef Cam Daniels will talk about cured egg yolks and what to do with them. Like this segment? I like me some cured egg yolks. And I am going to talk about why there's this like fear mantra being issued right now by the retards that did the BIP 110 thing and are now going to go off in hard fork. And I'm not really going to dance on their grave anymore. I'm kind of done with that. But there is this like one thing they did point out is like, it's centralized. The suit coiners, the spam, like, is Bitcoin still your number one option for freedom economically? The answer is yes. So I'm going to tell you why spam, suit coiners, all of it does not matter. This is a request that came in directly to me in from several different people on X where I was posting about some of this stuff, and I promised I would do it, so I'm going to take a segment because I don't think it rates a whole show. With that, let's go ahead and dig on into it and hear from Dr. Ron Paul and Dan McAdams on, has President Trump had a divorce with reality?
Well, the whole thing sort of started as a joke, Dr. Paul, and we talked about it yesterday, that Trump was speaking in front of all of these police officers association, and he sort of went off script according to the way it looked, at least, and he said, you know, maybe I'll even declare the Strait of Hormuz to be American territory. And I went, ah, ha, 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 ha. And then when people were saying that this is kind of outrageous to say this, the White House responded, just chill, relax, it's just a joke, it's no big deal. But what did Trump do? If you go to that first clip, he doubled down rather than just let it go, let it brush off as a joke. He drops a map of the Strait of Hormuz with as a new U.S. territory. Now go to that next clip and you can see what he wrote on Trump's Truth Social. New U.S. territory, the Strait of Hormuz. So doubling down, that was actually today, this morning at 7 a.m. We can actually even hear, there's a video of him saying, why not? Maybe I should just call it American territory. You might want to grab your earpiece, Dr. Paul, and let's listen to Trump in his own words.
This week you said that you would soon declare the Strait of Hormuz to be a territory of the United States. Could you elaborate?
Well, I think it's a great idea, yeah. I mean, we control it. We control it with the blockade. We have a blockade. We control it with the blockade. And I like the idea of declaring it a territory. We have total control over the Strait. Now, they can be a nuisance.
Well, there's an increasing gap, you know, between what President Trump says and objective reality.
This interventionism that we've been preaching against, that we ought to mind our own business, does not mean isolationism. It probably means a lot better conditions of intermingling and getting along and trading with people and engaging with people. So this business of saying you guys are not on the right track because you're a bunch of isolationists and you don't want to bring peace to the world. Well, reality is setting in, and I believe there's the mass majority in this country favor a more sensible foreign policy of why don't we just mind our own business?
So the only thing I can take exception to is that the whole team over there seems to feel that it's an any day thing that we finally pack up our shit and leave the Middle East and we accept the edges of empire are crumbling. And I'm not saying none of that's happening. I'm just saying it's not happening that fast, and don't hold your breath waiting for it, and don't think that's a solution to our problems. But on the divorce of reality, man, yeah. I mean, I'm going to change the title. Chris's was softer, right? Chris Messini, who sends them over from there for me. The way the guy's talking, now you can hear in the segment they play toward where Trump's talking toward the end, where he's pretty much acknowledging, obviously I'm not going to do this. He doesn't say it that directly, but I think it's a good idea. I like the idea. Things like that tell you right there that he knows he can't do this. And I think that's the important takeaway, because the subtards out there on the left are, hey, dude, he's not going to do it because he can't. He has no constitutional authority to do it. He can say whatever he wants. It doesn't mean anything, right? Like, it doesn't change the calculus on the ground at all. And that's why it seems kind of pointless. But he's been saying more and more things that come off so freaking unhinged. And I do think Trump's negotiation style, and again, I'm a guy that I read Trump's book, Art of the Deal, when I was in my 20s, and I'm in my 50s now. Okay. And I recently re-listened to it as an audio as part of my morning ritual. And he's a very good negotiator. He's very good at what he did before he was president. Remember, I was a consultant to one of his companies back in about the time that I started doing the show, honestly, like in the early to mid 2000s, Franklin Spirico Media had one of Trump's companies as our client, right? So we were consulting to the guy who is now the president of the United States. So I don't hate the guy. But this tactic does not work on the world stage. And even though I differ, I think, with the timeline that seems to be inferred, especially by Dan and Dr. Paul, I don't disagree with the outcome. We just crossed $40 trillion into debt. The entire world order is going to at some point have to kind of flip over. The United States cannot continue to be the world reserve currency indefinitely. And the people on TV tell you it's very important that we do so. And then the other counter people say, well, it'd be better off if we didn't. It doesn't matter which one's better. It matters which one's likely. Why would the world continue to attach themselves to the dollar if we continue to destroy it? And the answer is sooner or later they won't, but for now they will. How can I say that? Because we're the least stinky shirt in the hamper and there's no clean laundry. The dollar is the best bet that a country can make right now if they are also running a fiat economy. And no one has the balls right now to change that. The only other real options out there are gold and or silver, which are not going to work in a modern era. They're just not. Or something based on something like a Bitcoin, which they're not going to do that. I'm going to be giving you some real rah-rah for Bitcoin at the end of today's show, but I'm not going to tell you that all of a sudden all the nation states in the world are going to do this because the power of the one ring is sufficient to corrupt all. The ring must be destroyed by those who use it through their own incompetence of wielding its power for it to fail. There's no hobbits that are going to throw it into a volcano. I'll leave it at that for you Tolkien fans, and let's move on and talk about building community with Nicole Sauce.
Well, howdy TSP, Nicole Sauce here from the Living Free in Tennessee podcast with a question from Ryan Steva, the very own Ryan Steva that you know from the TSP Expert Council. He says, what are one or two large mistakes to avoid while trying to build community? Details. I work with a lot of people who are trying to build more resilient communities, and I'm wondering what are some of the problems that you have found and worked through as you build through yours. Are there a few boundaries or community norms you learned to implement the hard way, and what happened that taught you that lesson? Ryan, only two? Are you kidding me? Building community is something that is near and dear to my heart. As many of you know, the Living Free in Tennessee community has had its ups and downs over the past 10 years. But one thing that has held it together is a rabid commitment to embracing doers and walking away from community vampires. And sometimes that can mean I get to have hard conversations, but I'm up for it. So, wait, what? I think one of the biggest mistakes a person can make when building community is to build it. That's the biggest mistake. If you find yourself at the center of a community building project, you need to remember one big thing. You are not the builder of your community. Stop thinking of yourself that way. It lends itself to the wrong mindset, to what you want to see, which is a vibrant, independent community. If you are building it, you won't get that. That doesn't happen from you. So instead, embrace your role in the community growth project. And you may be the person who hosts the meetups and events, or you may be a connector, that person who always seems to know who to introduce whom to in the room. And that's me, by the way. Or you might be the one who shows up every time there's showing up to be had. There are many roles that can happen in a community. Figure out what yours is. That other mindset, the one about building that I was just talking about, that lends itself to negative things like possessiveness, jealousness, control, envy, meanness, mean-spiritedness, and it's because you think you own the community. You don't. If you want to build a strong community, the community owns itself. And that can be real hard for some of us liberty-minded people who love control, right? So don't get me wrong. You can still set boundaries you want in a community that you have sparked. But remember, your role is the spark. And the key word there is spark. The community has to do the work to become the community. And if you don't let that happen naturally, then you become just fettered in a really unhealthy spot. So that's the first mistake I see most often. Second, stressing out that your community is too small. Size does not matter in this case. Like, for real, does not matter. So a healthy community does. If you spark a community that has all the things needed to thrive, and then what you see that you're getting is some really quality people drawn to participate, that's good. And if there's only three of them, that's good. You have three quality people, not 30 crappy people in your community. The Holler Neighbors, for example, we're just four households who live near each other. Four. That's four. That's not very many. But that's plenty to be a force when stuff is needed and when we start serving as our hub role, in our hub role, which is something we do all the time. So, for example, when Helene happened, we became a hub center for routing supplies from other places to East Tennessee to help the victims get access immediately and quickly. And that meant sometimes people were staying here who were on their way there. That meant we could collect things here and send it there. And we were a powerhouse for that because we're four quality households acting in community that has developed over time, right? So that's what we need when we want to leverage something, is that strong core. And the other cool thing about having a small but mighty community is that I can tap into people who live near me when one household is off for a week at the Self-Reliance Festival, for example, and the animals on my homestead can be covered. Because something that can be tricky about living the lifestyle we live here is that you can't leave unless you can. And the only way you can is by leveraging community. Now, that doesn't mean that there's not more to the community than the four near each other here, but it has helped. And then there's this like layer outside of that of the most involved quality members that I would count in the 20s right now in Tennessee. And then across the country, it's about 100, right? So understand, this is not thousands of people. It's just something that started small and got bigger, and we just have been really great that the community has been, like, lucky that we've been growing ourselves as a community as we want, according to just a simple core principle of if you're a doer, you can come, and if you are a taker, you won't last long here. So just size does not matter. Quality matters. So stop hanging on to those unhealthy actors in your community and see what happens next. You will feel relief. You will suddenly have time, and you'll get twice the things accomplished that you could when you had all the lurkers around there. So for you, Ryan, I have a third bonus item today, and that's that community builds itself when good things are accomplished. I think the best way to gain momentum is to give community members something to do. Not just come listen to a speaker, but something to do with their hands in their day-to-day life. So our wider network shrinks every time I stop hosting events, for example. And that's why one of the reasons we're having Alan Booker out to do a Living Soil class here on October 2nd and 3rd, livingfreeintennessee.com. We're doing Living Soil and Microscopy, partially because the community is dying to learn more about how they can assess their soil by looking through a microscope after they have implemented Jack's bioreactor compost method, right? But also, it's so we can get together and learn how to make our shared interests, our homesteads, better. And that reminds us why we are the community that we are. And we'll have some fun while we're doing it, right? So if you're not the role in your community of being a center or an event planner sort of thing, or a reason to get together and do something, that's fine. Not everybody should be that part. But find out who is in your community and give them a hand. Because being the center meeting place by yourself is exhausting. And the whole purpose of having community is that we lift each other up and we can lighten everybody's loads, provide stronger connection the way community should be, and stop letting society define what community is for us. So I hope this answers your question, guys. If you want to follow me, get involved in any of these cool things that we're doing here, go to livingfreeintennessee.com to find out more. Make it a great week.
This is one of those things I've thought about for a long time, like community building, right? Like the act of actually intentionally creating community. And sometimes I actually wonder if we should even be thinking that way at all. And let me explain what I mean by that. I'm not being anti-community here, even though reality is, like, I'm this big community leader, but in real life I am kind of a loner type of person. Doesn't mean I don't value community. I'm not willing to contribute, and I don't appreciate when other people help me. But that's not where I'm coming from with this at all. All I'm trying to do is now just think in my, you know, 50-odd years of life, when was I in true community with others in an IRL way? Like, not virtual community like we've created with TSP, because obviously this community is amazing. It's made up of many sub-communities and what have you. But maybe it actually makes the same point in that I didn't create TSP with the idea I will create a community and sub-communities of sub-communities. I created TSP with the idea of I will create something that helps people learn and encourages them to take positive action, and the community formed around it organically. So back to where I was going from this, where have I been in the tightest community relationships in real life in my 50-odd years? And here's the answer. Growing up in rural Pennsylvania, once we moved from Florida, the place had a very tight-knit community. There were ethnic divisions, but they were all fanciful and fun because everybody just considered themselves a coal regioner first. So, like, you knew which kids were like the and I don't mean anything insulting by this, because we all said this shit to each other. The Polacks, right? And the Irish and the Yukies like me, right? Everybody knew who everybody was, but nobody really held it against anybody. It was just kind of like banter. But banter was part of the community. But what was the community really based on? It was based on a multi-generational reality. Grandmas and grandpas and great aunts and uncles and moms and dads and kids, right? All being part of this same kind of local environment. And it centered a lot around, in that area anyway, churches. Primarily Catholic, Ukrainian, and Roman Catholic churches. It also centered around things like volunteer firehouse, VFW, things like that. And it centered around community icons, like the guy I mentioned so many times, Buddy Shoemaker, the guy that made wine, and he knew everybody. And if you needed something and Buddy liked you, you were going to get it, because he'd make a phone call and somebody would do it. I don't think that when the whole thing began, and really the area I'm talking about really began with the people that I'm talking about around the late 1800s to early 1900s. This is when my great-grandparents came into this area, and there wasn't very much there at the time. I don't think any of them ever got together and said, let's make a community. What it ended up being is a place where a lot of people worked blue-collar work. As the industrial might was built up somewhat in Pennsylvania, it was not just coal miners. It was steel workers, metal workers, mill workers, etc. There was swing shift. Literally, like, kids went to bed at 9 o'clock at night was when you heard the shift horn go off for the factory in town. Like, that became like, it's 9 o'clock, it's time to go to bed. Or if you got to stay up later, 9:30, you knew that you had 30 minutes to go to bed. Right? This is the kind of place this was. And I don't think anybody said, let's make a community. But when somebody needed something, it happened. And so I think that fostering the type of society that creates trust is how communities have traditionally formed. And that tells me, perhaps, that means the reason we have to force community now, we have to have people like Nicole who can be, no matter what she says, a community builder. Right, in that she is kind of the force at the center that creates the orbit of people who then naturally and organically commune together, is necessary because society lost trust. That may be a show that we should do. How do we restore trust in society? Because I think that's why we're trying to build community, because that trust itself has been lost. That might be a good one for me and Nicole to team up on together. Anyway, let's move on now, and let's talk about security of your email address and how it relates to security of your other personal accounts with Jesse Markowitz.
Hi, this is Jesse Markowitz from yourpersonalbitcoinassistant.com. Today, I have a question from Bruce. Bruce saw a post on X warning that your primary email account may be one of the most important accounts you have to protect. The post said, if someone gets your primary email, they don't need your credit card, they can drain every account you own in under an hour using password resets. Then it gave a long and complicated checklist of ways to secure your email. Bruce's question, do I really need to do all this? Is this good advice? Yes, your email account is unusually important because it often acts as the recovery channel for many of your other accounts. But that lead-in line is clickbait hyperbole. Someone who compromises your Gmail account is very unlikely to be able to drain every account you own in under an hour. Banks, brokerages, crypto exchanges, and other services have different security and recovery systems. Still, the post raises a good point that many people have not given enough thought to. Click forgot password on a website, and there's a very good chance the website sends something to your email address. So if somebody controls your email, that gives them a starting point. So what's realistic? How much do you need to worry about this? What are the critical things you really need to do? Let's start with the basics. 1. Do not reuse your passwords. This is probably the most important place to start. If you're not doing this already, use a password manager. This makes it easy to create a complex, unique password for each of your accounts. You don't need to remember them. Let the password manager generate and store them for you. Personally, I use a self-hosted Vault Warden on my StarOS server, but there are other good options out there as well. This way, when some random website you signed up for 5 years ago gets breached, the password exposed there does not also unlock your email, bank, brokerage, Amazon account, or anything else. Password reuse turns one company's security failure into your security failure. 2. Don't use your important email address everywhere. The email address you use for your bank does not need to be the same one you use for newsletters, contests, stores, coupons, and every other random service on the internet. If your current email is already used for everything, create a separate address for your most important accounts and start using it going forward. Don't try to fix everything today. As you log into important older accounts, move them over one at a time. Better is better. You do not have to solve the whole problem in one afternoon. 3. Turn on two-factor authentication for your email and other important accounts. If your provider offers two-factor authentication, use it. An authenticator app, a passkey, or hardware security key is definitely stronger than an SMS text message. But if SMS is what you can do, use that. Do not let perfect prevent you from doing anything. Next, protect the device that protects your email. For most people today, your phone contains your email, your password manager, authenticator app, passkeys, banking apps, and access to all of your cloud accounts. It's not just your phone, it's your keyring and wallet too. So don't leave it lying around. Keep it close and use a good PIN or passcode. Use Face ID, fingerprints, whatever other biometric protection your phone supports. Keep the operating system updated. And if your phone is lost or stolen, know how to remotely lock or erase it. Finally, identify your most important accounts and understand the recovery path. What if you lost access to your email or your phone? Is there a recovery email, phone number, or recovery code you still control? This isn't something you need to work through for every account you've ever created. Start with the accounts that really matter. Pick one. Start there. Making your situation better is worth doing, even if you cannot make it perfect. One additional note for higher risk people. If you run a business, control valuable infrastructure, keep substantial assets on exchanges or other online financial accounts, or otherwise expect targeted accounts, stronger measures may make sense. Physical security keys, tighter recovery settings, dedicated email accounts. For most people, do the boring fundamentals well first. This has been Jesse Markowitz from yourpersonalbitcoinassistant.com. Thanks for the question, Bruce. Everyone, please keep sending them in to Jack. If you're interested in my assistance with a Bitcoin risk assessment or other consulting on Bitcoin, Start9, or other technology questions, please reach out. And if you'd like to listen to me on my Bitcoin Pivot podcasts, you can hear them at thebitcoinpivot.com/podcasts.
The most important two pieces of advice in there are probably protect the device itself. That's your phone. And then the second most important, and might actually be the most important, it's just that without protecting your phone, you lose this, is the two-factor authentication. If someone has your email address, but all of your primary things that you would worry about risking, and they can, let's say somebody has access to your email, so they can send a thing to get a password reminder, right, from your bank or whatever, but you have 2FA there, then they have, it's like the multi-sig in Bitcoin, where you have to have two keys to move the Bitcoin. They have one key, the email account, but they don't have the ability to receive the text or use Google Authenticator or whatever is the 2FA. Now, if they get your device, you have bigger problems. And I would tell you that his suggestion that the minute you know your device is compromised, being able to basically wipe the device remotely, know how to do that with Apple is very easy. I don't really know exactly what to do with Android. If you like our Android with a major character, I don't know, but I'm sure they have something very similar. So iPhone has iCloud, and you go there and you can like find your device and stuff like that. And so I use that all the time because I ADD disappear things, as Nicole Sauce often says about me, and she's right. So my phone might just be a little bit away for me in the dark, and I can't see it in the dark without my glasses on, so I go there. But that option of play a sound to find it or whatever also lets me see where it is. Like one time, where's my phone? Well, it was at the restaurant you left it at, stupid. But if it were not where it's supposed to be and you really believe it's compromised, with a click, you can basically wipe it. And then you still have all of it backed up on iCloud or whatever, hopefully, and you can restore it when you get a new device. So that's really important. But there's something else in this that I want to give you, like my old school old man method of helping to protect with this. This is not foolproof, but it's pretty useful. Because I host my own email, and because I'm old and I like Outlook, and I know that makes me old and I understand that, but you can use other clients for this. I just know Outlook works for it perfectly. I actually leave Outlook open and my desktop computer on at all times. I run old school email that allows me to have Outlook once every minute reach out to the server, grab everything, pull it down onto my local computer, and at that moment, it's deleted off the remote server. So all my emails in one place, and you would not be able to just hack into like username, email, and password. You would actually have to be able to get into my home computer to access the historical record. Additionally, if you're trying to trigger recovery information, the longest it could possibly be there for you to get your hands on it is 1 minute. And every time that call is made by Outlook, it's going to pull it down. And that means that you can only get about 1 minute worth of email at any one time. Again, it's not foolproof, but to me, it is a byproduct security thing. Like, I did it that way because it would make my life easier. And then I'm like, oh, there's some security advantages. So I want to throw that out. Because sometimes when you throw out what you do, and you listen to somebody else what they do, and then you come up with your own version. So I thought that might be helpful to somebody out there. Now let's talk about weight loss, fitness, what exercise can and can't do for you, and how lifting heavy weights actually can help you lose weight or at least be more trim. Let's hear from Andy.
Hello and good morning. This is Andy McCann coming to you from Woodstock, Georgia, where I own CrossFit Garage. And yes, I do love CrossFit. I'm not afraid to say it. Okay, so I got a question from Stephanie. She said, what exercises should I do to optimize for losing weight? Okay, so you're not going to like this answer. The answer is not do CrossFit, but it's going to be, it's not really about exercise, it's about eating. So I would adjust the way you eat. First, abs are made in the kitchen. There's a lot of things that when we eat, it just inflames us. So really understanding what we're eating and how it interacts with your body is probably more important than the exercises that you're doing. But you said exercises, so what would I do? I would start strength training. And the reason is, if you can increase your metabolism, then you will burn more of the calories you're ingesting throughout the day, not just while working out. So just go with the numbers here. I'm making this stuff up because round numbers are easier to work with. Let's say you go on a jog for an hour and you burn, 200 calories. That's an aggressive jog, I know. That's it. When you're done jogging, you're done burning those extra calories. You just went up by 200. And so now you can eat something that's extra 200 or whatever, right? So the other side of that is, instead of just burning for that 1 hour, what if you built more muscle? Yeah, I know muscles are heavier, so you're going to weigh more. But typically when people say, I want to lose weight, it's really, I want my clothes to fit better. So if you built muscle, which is heavier, it's going to request more from your body throughout the day, even while sleeping. So instead of having a calorie burn rate of, let's say 1800 calories per day, by building muscle, you're going to move that up to, say, 1900 calories a day. So doing absolutely nothing extra, your body's still saying, hey, I want to feed these muscles because you've asked me for them and I want to build them. So I would add strength training. Then the question becomes, well, how much strength training? What should I be doing? Should I be Olympic lifting? Should I be powerlifting? Should I be a gym bro? No, that's not what you should do. It doesn't really have to be much. You just want to continually move the needle some with your body. Yes, you'll probably get to a point where it's like, hey, the needle's not moving anymore. That's fine. We'll change it up at that point. I would stick with some of the bigger lifts that move more muscle parts than others. So, for example, I would not do bicep curls. That's not what I'm talking about. I would do the power lifts, which would be back squat, bench press or strict press, and deadlift. I would stick with those. And I would probably, for you, I would superset them such that I could rotate through them and keep going. And I would do maybe a 3 days a week type of thing. So maybe Monday, Wednesday, Friday or something like that, getting yourself a little bit of rest. Now, ideally, you would do it with even more rest and more like traditional guy style of back, by chest and try. The reason they use that is to build muscle for looks. It's better to wait longer. Now, to build muscle for strength, you don't actually have to wait as much. So when you tear down your muscle, when you give it rest time, it's going to enlarge to become bigger. Now, it's not going to make you enlarged as in, oh no, look at that woman with these huge traps. It's not going to do that. So I would add in maybe like a back squat deadlift and then, deadlift strict pressed and then back squat bench press and then rotate through that Monday, Wednesday, Friday. The reason you want strength, again, is it builds muscle. It's also going to increase bone density. And if you've got joint issues, the best way to put material, blood, so forth, into your joints is to allow it to compress and decompress. So that's going to say, hey, send me stuff. That's how you actually help your joints out. So the best exercise you could do to lose weight in the long run is to add in strength training. Now, if you're like, Andy, I just need to lose weight right now because I have a wedding coming up in, 3 months, then it's totally different. I would go find your local high school wrestling coach and say, hey, how do you help these kids lose weight? And I would do what they say. It's terrible for you, and I would never repeat it, but if you only have 3 months and you really want to lose weight, talk to a wrestling coach. It's going to be very low calorie, lots of plastic bags and sweating and jump rope and spitting into a cup because you have chew in your mouth, and maybe enemas, right? So it's not glorious, but that's an easier way to lose weight is follow a wrestler's protocol to drop weight. But that's not sustainable at all. Okay, so back to the serious stuff. I would still do things like on the other days, maybe add in something longer like a jog or a row or a bike, something that you enjoy that you'll do. The worst thing you can ever do is try to come up with a routine that you just can't make routine because you hate it. So add in strength, build your muscles, increase your metabolism, because over time, that little bit that you're growing is going to compound through the daily activity and even while sleeping. All right, guys, if you need help with any of this stuff, you can find me, Andy, at CrossFitGarage.com. I have a bunch of coaches that work for me, and I'm happy to connect you with one of them for either some online virtual private training with strength, or even on the nutrition side. Y'all take care.
So I'll reiterate what he's saying about what you eat being more important to your weight than your activity level. There's an old saying, and I believe that it's absolutely true. and it is that you cannot outrun a bad diet. In other words, I don't care how much you go to the gym and work out. If you eat a lot of Twinkies and Ho-Hos, you're going to have a lot more body fat on than you want to. I will say also, though, that the advice of strength training to lose weight is very good. And I listened to the segment to make sure I wasn't repeating him, and I don't think I heard it, but the exercise that I believe has been scientifically proven, by the way, to be the best for weight loss is squatting. And specifically squatting, not necessarily going to max squats where you push it up like that, you know, like, but you know, something in the neighborhood of like where 5 reps is your limit, 5 to 6 reps somewhere in there being your limit, where either you have to drop the bar onto, you know, something lower, you need a little bit of a spot, or you got your 5th, but you damn well know if you tried your 6th, you wouldn't, something in that range. This is just something you need to be careful and make sure you're set up right to do if you're doing it without a spotter, because it is an exercise where you can get hurt. The reason is everybody squats legs. Well, I'm going to tell you that when you squat, the one place you really don't do a lot of work with is going to be your arms, but the rest of your freaking body, your core, your back, you're engaging, yes, you're engaging those quads, right? You're engaging a significant amount of muscle. So your quads, right, your gluteus, et cetera, these are the biggest muscles in the body. So even that is a lot of muscle relative to your total body. But it's also, it's the muscles in your feet. As your feet are making these little micro adjustments, right? And that sheer volume of muscle that's requiring energy is very calorically hungry. Other exercises you can do that are not weight bearing but are incredible for caloric burning. My number one is going to be rowing, and you could do heavy rows, but classic, like, good high-end rowing machines if you're in a gym. The first time I ever worked out on a rowing machine, I did it with my father when I was a teenager. And we both agreed that 5 minutes on a rowing machine of putting some work into it, you felt like you'd just been shoveling coal for 15 minutes with a number 10 coal shovel. And you ain't never had a hard breather like I'm talking about if you've never done that. Now, of course, you adapt to it, and it doesn't stay that hard to do 5 minutes on it. But that is another great exercise. And it's the same thing. Everybody, cardio, right. Okay, when you do rowing, yes, it's cardio. But think about what I just said about squats. The only major muscle group you're not engaging when you do squats is pretty much your arms. Well, when you row, you're doing that too. You're literally engaging every major muscle group in the body in sustained physical exertion. That burns calories. It also builds muscle, right? Have you ever seen one of these guys that's like a sculler, you know, rowing team member in college, but they're toned and they're built? And so the other side of this is he talked about upping your metabolism with muscle. It's not just metabolism in and of itself, the way we think of it, like a hummingbird versus a monkey or a gorilla or something, or a hippo or an elephant. It is the sheer amount of energy necessary to sustain it. So when you have a pound of fat, the only time it's ever affecting how much energy you burn is when you get up and move. Because it takes almost no energy at all to maintain fat. It's a battery. It takes energy to maintain the rest of your body. And the most intensive, about the only piece of fat in your body that actually is energy intensive is your brain. And that's because of what's going on inside of it, not what it's made of. It's the neurons inside of it. Your brain uses about 20% of your calories, believe it or not. And I think a lot of people maybe use it a little bit less. But when you have muscle, like he said, even when you're sleeping, it takes energy to maintain that muscle. So a person who gains 5 pounds of muscle, loses 5 pounds of fat, is in a much better position, not just because they're stronger and look better, but because they effectively have raised that metabolism, not in the way many people think of it, as in, like, we all know the person's just all energetic all the time, right? I don't mean it that way. I mean, literally, the body simply requires more calories to maintain itself, so it takes a lot more calories now to make it bigger from a fat standpoint. And on the muscle thing with women, this is always the thing you hear from women whenever you talk about lifting weights. I don't want to get big. You're not. You're not. And the women you see that do it, they are training incredibly intensively, and 99% of them that really put on muscle where they look very muscular. I'm not talking about lean and tanned and whatever. I'm talking where you're like, if I didn't see breasts or a face, that could be a dude, that kind of muscle. They're on testosterone, and I don't care who says they're not. They're on testosterone. You go out and lift weights every day, ladies. You are not going to look like that. I promise you. Extremely intensive training and some level of supplementation, because you're not designed to build a body that way. I know you're going to tell me about the one, and I'm going to tell you that I'm giving you the 99%, not even the 75% in the bell curve on this one. All right, so let's move on and hear about Bitcoin and investing or buying houses or paying off mortgages with John Pugliano.
Hello, TSP. Well, we have an interesting question from Dave, and this question has a whole lot of elements to it. So I'm going to read it to you, and then I'll try and unpack the pertinent parts to it. So he starts out by saying, should I buy Bitcoin or pay off an 8% loan on a duplex? His background information is that this fall there will be enough cash in my Roth to buy a Bitcoin on sale. And I'm assuming there when he says on sale, he means he thinks that Bitcoin's going to maybe hit another low this fall. I think that's what he means. Then he goes on to say, or pay off a loan on one of my duplexes. I'm old enough to pull money out of the Roth without penalty, and using this money will not affect my retirement. I intend to build a personal residence in a couple of years, which should correspond with a new Bitcoin high. This new Bitcoin would be in the form of an ETF in my Roth, so no taxes when I cash it out to build the house. Or if I pay it off the loan, I would get a new mortgage on the duplex to build the new house. Okay, so like I said, there's a lot there. I'm not going to answer them directly because I'm making a lot of assumptions here that may not be accurate. And so, Dave, if I don't give you the right answer, get in touch with me and we can talk about your personal situation. But let me break it down the way I see it. And I'm not giving him financial advice. I'm simply giving you my opinion and telling you what I would do in his situation. Now, as far as investing in Bitcoin through a spot ETF in his Roth, I generally like that idea. I actually think what he's doing, though, is not investing. I think he's speculating because, again, if I'm interpreting his question properly, you know, he's saying he wants to buy it later in the year when he thinks it's going to be on sale, and then he wants to turn around and sell it during the next cycle when hopefully it coordinates to when he's going to want to build his house. To me, that's not investing, that's speculation, but that's okay too. I don't really have a problem with that. I think doing it in the Roth makes a lot of sense because it's tax-free. I also personally like the idea of speculating on a spot ETF when Bitcoin is trading below its 200-day moving average. And although today as I record this, it did bounce up to the 200-day moving average. It's been below that for quite a while. It's been doing a lot of consolidation. I have no idea if it's going to go higher or lower from here. But if I was going to buy it, I would want to buy it when it is below a long-term, like a 4-year moving average, which, again, pretty much is where it is right now. Now, as to taking money out of the Roth and paying off the mortgage, even though you wouldn't pay a penalty for it, Dave, I would personally never do that. To me, Roth is sacred money, and I say that because it can compound tax-free throughout your lifetime. If you're married and you die before your spouse, it could continue to compound tax-free throughout her life. And then even when either of you die, your beneficiaries have another 10 years to let it grow before they're required to liquidate it. So in my mind, Roth money is sacred. It's the last money I ever want to spend. And so for that reason, I personally would not take money out of a Roth to pay off a mortgage. And in particular, in your case, and again, I'm interpreting this into your question, But you say that the mortgage you want to pay off is on a duplex, and it does have a high interest rate. It's 8%. But I'm assuming that that duplex is rental property. And in terms of a commercial loan like that on rental property, you know, 8% really isn't out of the ordinary. And even just the way regular 30-year interest rates are right now, you know, you're still within a reasonable amount. And so I would really be looking at that property. And again, assuming that it's income-producing rental property, it should be paying off with enough cash flow and more than enough cash flow to not only, you know, pay the 8% mortgage, but also to be generating income for you. And if that's not the case, then rather than looking at paying off the mortgage, I'd be saying maybe this isn't such a great return on my investment, and maybe I'd want to sell that property and invest in something that does have better cash flow or better income potential. The other thing I want to mention here, and again, I'm reading into your question, so this may not be the case, but I think you're saying that one Bitcoin would pay that mortgage off. When you sent in this question, Bitcoin was trading, you know, down in the low 60s, I think, and you think it's going to further go on sale, again, if I'm understanding your question right. And so really you're talking about an overall mortgage on a rental property that's maybe somewhere around the $40,000 to $60,000 range. That's really what I would consider a very small mortgage on rental property. And one of the areas that I think it makes sense to carry debt is on income-producing rental property. So a small amount like that wouldn't bother me at all, again, assuming that this is a good property and it's paying you the kind of income you want. And then really where I drill down in your question is, you know, you end out saying that really no matter what, you're either going to sell the profit in the Bitcoin or take out another loan against the duplex to pay for your new house. And you mentioned that you're, you know, I know you're at least over 59 and a half. So what I'm reading into your question is that you're looking at being at or near retirement age in your 60s and still having some kind of a mortgage on a new house. And I'm assuming this is your main house you're going to live in. If that's the case, I'd really encourage you to think twice about taking on mortgage debt on your primary residence when you're, you know, 60 plus years old. Again, I don't know your whole background or how much income you have coming from other areas, but generally when I see someone that's in their 60s and they haven't paid off their home yet, that's really a red flag that they don't have good, solid financial resilience. So in any case, just my opinions. Thanks for your question. Until next time, this is John Pugliano from Investable Wealth and the Wealth Studying Podcast.
So I'm thinking that the speculating is to pay off the house and still have the money. That's what I'm thinking. And so John had his golden rule about Roth IRA, Roth anything, IRA, Roth 401, whatever. I agree with the rule. I completely, unless all the money that you have for your retirement is in a Roth, it's sacred. And a financial advisor I used to work with, it would call it never money. And I always push back and say, no, it's last money. That's last money. And what I mean by that is that if you have money set aside in retirement inside a Roth, and you have other money for your retirement that's not inside a Roth, especially if it involves liquidating securities and paying taxes, you spend all the other money first, and you let the Roth money continue to accrue as long as possible. But of course, if you're sitting there and you have $3.5 million in your Roth, have about 10 years left of your life to live, okay, and you're out of other money, of course you draw from it. That's what it's there for. But it would be the last money to touch. I completely agree with that. Now, on the, if you're going to do the Bitcoin, which based on the fact that it doesn't sound like this debt is in any way burdensome to you at all, okay, like you don't need to pay the debt off. The odds that you say just over the next 5 years that Bitcoin will return more than the house will save you in interest are like really, 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 really super high. Okay? Really super high. However, he says Bitcoin's going to be on sale. Well, Bitcoin green candled people right through the eyeball yesterday, and I'm still saying the bottom's not in on the cycle. I'm also willing to tell you that I think that the bottom comes in on the cycle in Q4. That is most likely. If it's not Q4, it's very late Q3 or very early Q127. It's somewhere in that space that Bitcoin has made these really big moves up. And I actually did a post today where I posted side-by-side pictures of graphs of the Bitcoin price. And the first graph is a graph of a one-month line graph. And in that one-month line graph, the last 2 days are this straight cliff arrow up. And then the next one is showing it over 1 year with a annualized loss of 36.24%. And that super stiff cliff going straight up is a little bitty pink finger sitting up at the end of it, right? So Bitcoin, and if you want, look at that particular graph, you'll see 1, 2, 3 bigger 2 day slides down. Okay. And you'll see one, you know, on that 1 year, one bigger 1 day spike up. There's another spike that's close, but it's over about a week. Okay. What does that mean? It's a volatile asset. It goes up and down. Here's what I said in my post. I said, I know if you're a Bitcoiner, the last 2 days feel pretty good, big green candles and all. But keep perspective. This isn't the new bull yet. Of course, this is my opinion. Keep perspective. Chart one, this is 1 month, is how you feel. Chart two is 1 year of reality. Stay humble, stack sats, and be grateful for every dip. Now, I also always say I reserve the right to be wrong. I'm giving you my best estimate. Now, the last cycle, as we came through the bull in the end, I called the bottom price within $800. I was $800 off. It was actually more like $695 or something, but when you round it off and don't try to just catch it just perfect, it was about $800 off, meaningful bottom. I got the time within a couple weeks. So I'm pretty good at the macro analysis. I'm not a day trader. I've never tried to be. But I could be wrong. Like, there's a lot of factors in play right now. Maybe we do start a bull market early. I don't know. But how do you take, if you decide to buy the Bitcoin inside IBIT, because, and this is, by the way, why would you buy IBIT? Well, Jack, I tell you, for self-custody, I don't own any fucking IBIT, okay? But I have a shitload of Bitcoin, and I've been stacking it outside of any kind of investment platform for a long, or any kind of, like, IRA or whatever for a long time. A lot of people have their money tied up, all their excess capital is tied up in one of these 401ks, IRAs, whatever. This is why you do it, right? But you don't have to buy a Bitcoin all at once. Now, I just actually gave a friend and neighbor some advice who has a fairly big chunk of cash that they want to reserve for a while and try to earn some money. And I said, maybe you take 10, 20% of it and divide it by the number of days between, let's say, September 1st when you get the money and December 31st at the end of the year, and put it in strike and then do a daily DCA, right? You're not going to do that with an IRA. But what you can do is go September, October, November, December, right? 5 months, yeah? 0.2 Bitcoin every month, right? Whatever that is in IBIT shares. That would be a way to, if we're wrong and if recovery has already begun, you begin buying in before too much recovery happens. If we're right, we still capture a significant amount of the dip. And depending on how you personally feel, because I'm not locking that in as this is what to do, this is one strategy you can take, you might extend that out into like January, February, and do your math from there. Or if you can buy in August, make that work, maybe you do this over 6 months, right? Or maybe you do it over 10 months. And then you buy a tenth of a Bitcoin in price value in IBIT. Like, just think about that strategy and then figure out what works for you, okay? That's how I would do it, because what I would not suggest right now is buying a full Bitcoin. It'll work out, but you don't have to, so I don't like losing optionality when we still have it. And I'm telling you that everything in my gut says we're not done with the down yet. We have never had a bull market start in August at this point in the cycle. It just hasn't happened. Can it happen? Sure. We never had this time coincide with Bitcoin ETFs and people like Michael Saylor and everybody else that's out there and Bitcoin treasury companies. Like, there's more money being pushed in than ever, even now. But I still just don't think we're going to break it. I don't think this time's different, man, is what I'm saying. So you can hedge that way. All right, let's hear about cooking, right? This is something totally different because I got some Bitcoin stuff for you here at the end. But cooking with Chef Ken, and in this case, less cooking and more food prep, something really cool, salt-cured egg yolks.
Hello all, Chef Ken here. Today we're going to talk about salt-curing egg yolks. And if you've never made these before, this is one of those techniques where the finished product looks like you've done something incredibly sophisticated, when in reality you've just buried egg yolk in salt and forgotten about it for a couple of days, dried it out, and somehow come away looking like you know what the hell you're doing. Because salt-cured eggs are genuinely useful. We're taking something soft, rich, extremely perishable, and changing its texture until eventually we have this little firm golden puck that we can grate over food. You'll hear people compare it to like Parmesan, and that's not a terrible way to explain how it's used, but I don't expect it to taste like Parmesan. It tastes like egg yolk, and it's been concentrated down to its essentials. It is 100% pure umami. So let's get started. For this, I want regular salt. Personally, I'd reach for plain, non-iodinized kosher salt. I generally don't use table salt for this. It certainly cured the yolk, but I don't need the addition of iodine or the other additives. Now, there is one thing I want you to spend money on if you haven't already. That's a kitchen scale. Don't measure this by cups. Salt is one of those ingredients that exposes the weakness of volume measurements very quickly. Fine salt packs tightly. Kosher salt doesn't. You can put a cup of each on a scale and discover you've dramatically got different amounts of actual salt. A gram is a gram, so use the scale. For a basic batch, I'd like equal parts of salt and ordinary granulated sugar. And before somebody writes me saying, Chef Ken, I thought we were curing these in salt. Why are you adding sugar? Because I do not want them to taste like a damn salt lick. The sugar participates in drawing moisture from the yolk while tempering the aggressive saltiness of the straight salt cure. Plus, I've got plans for this curing mixture after the yolk. We're simply building a more balanced cure. Mix the salt and sugar together, then put a good layer in the bottom of a container. If you're doing 12 eggs, obviously you're going to need a little more space. I personally like to keep 2 inches from each yolk in the container. I want enough salt underneath that none of them are resting directly against the bottom. I take the back of a spoon, I make a little depression in the cure, and that's where the yolks are going to sit. Now separate your eggs and take your time. Just like when I'm making eggnog, I crack everything into one bowl and I use my fingers and hands to cradle out the yolks individually. I've seen every technique under the sun. Use your hands and fingers. Place the intact yolks gently into the little depressions and give them some room. Then start spooning the cure around them and eventually over the top. Be gentle here. You don't need to dump 5 pounds of salt onto them like you're filling a pothole. Once they're completely covered, put the container in the refrigerator and leave them alone. Do not check on them. How long? It depends. I've done quail yolk and it maybe takes 12 to 18 hours. Chicken yolk for me, 2 days, and that's my personal sweet spot. Duck yolk, maybe 3 days. But really, it's all about texture and how they feel. I want firmness, no jiggle, if I were to shake that pan. So what's happening underneath that cure is pretty fascinating. Egg yolk contains a substantial amount of water, along with other wonderful fats and proteins. Surrounding them with this concentrated cure draws water away from the yolk. As this happens, the texture begins changing. The yolk gets firmer. The flavor becomes more concentrated, and over several days it goes from something that would burst if you handled it wrong to something that you can actually pick up. And that's the part of the process I love. You're not really adding flavor as much as you're concentrating what's already there. If you have a homestead and you have birds that are producing incredibly delicious eggs, do this and you'll be amazed at the flavor of these yolks. Carefully dig it out. Brush away as much as you can. If there's stubborn salt and sugar that's stuck to the surface, you can give it a very quick rinse. But remember, what we've been trying to do for the last several days is we're trying to remove water. This would be a strange moment to give it a bath. Do it. Quick rinse. Pat it thoroughly dry. At this point, you have something that's firm, but still somewhat pliable. You can stop here, and you've got spreadable yolk that's insane on toast. But what I'm looking for is that gratable Parmesan-looking kind of yolk. So let's push onward. Now we dry, and this is where I want to separate two ideas from getting mashed together. Curing and drying are not the same. The cure removed a lot of moisture and changed the yolk. The drying stage is what takes us toward that hard, gratable texture. A dehydrator is wonderful for this because literally what the machine is built to do, control temperature with moving air. I'm looking at about 150 degrees Fahrenheit. For me, it's about an hour to 2 hours, no more. The first time you make one, grate a little directly onto your hand and taste it. Taste the ingredients you just made. You'll immediately understand why chefs love these little things. It's unmistakably egg yolk, but everything has been turned up. There's salt, richness, savoriness. Pasta obviously works. Put it over asparagus, a little butter, lemon. Grate it over potatoes, grilled cabbage or Brussels sprouts. Especially if you've been following along with our mushroom series, get a pan of lion manes, oyster mushrooms, and then at the end, just grate some of this yolk over the top. Works good over steaks too, over soups. My personal favorite is popcorn. If you have this with popcorn, I promise you, you'll be addicted. Salt curing is absolutely a preservation technique. Drying is a preservation technique as well. Both make conditions less hospitable to microbial growth by reducing available moisture. After that is all said and done, mine stay in the fridge. I'm certainly not squeamish about uncooked egg, considering the amount of eggnog I make every year. But take your necessary safety measures that make you feel comfortable. This should be a staple in your homesteading kitchen, just like eggnog. And if you've got chickens, you understand the abundance. There are portions of the year where you're guarding every egg like it's a treasure, and then suddenly all your chickens or ducks decide to go full in production, and you're standing with eggs everywhere. This is when you need to start thinking differently. Too much milk becomes cheese. Too much cabbage becomes sauerkraut or kimchi. Too much fruit gets dried, fermented, frozen, canned, yada, yada, yada. And an abundance of eggs gives us the opportunity to ask the same question. For the love of God, do not throw out that salt and sugar cure from the fridge the yolks were in. This is where I make salmon gravlax. And if you want to know how to do this, my next segment, we will dive into this. This has been a quick tip for today's segment. Keep your questions coming in to BloodSugarChef.com. Until next time, this is Ken, your Blood Sugar Chef. Cheers.
Great segment. I'll just tell you what I do when I do salted egg yolks. I take a dish, and I put about 3/4 of an inch of salt in it. I take my fingers and make little divots, and I put the yolks in them, and then I lightly sprinkle salt on top, leave it uncovered, and I throw it in the refrigerator for a few days until it gets hard. That's all I do with them. I have had them need a little finishing in the oven because I needed them to get there quicker. But generally, I don't waste salt. I don't do anything. Salt's cheap. You know, one use type of salt use thing, or I have done back to back where like take them out, make some holes, throw more yolks in, and then fresh salt on the top, and maybe do that twice. But that's all I do. I've never done a little bit of yolks like quail though, but duck egg yolks are freaking amazing this way. Microplane grater. If you've been here to workshops, you've probably had the opportunity for some of my egg yolks. That way when we do the bagel bar. Oh, by the way, the workshop this year, my neighbor who I mentioned in the last segment that I gave some Bitcoin advice to, his wife makes sourdough. And I don't know how much she's going to be able to make for the workshop because they have one oven, but she's definitely in on doing the bagels. So this year's bagels for our bagel bar on Thursday morning are going to be locally made sourdough. And when I say local, 3/4 of a mile. Roughly as the crow flies from my house. That's pretty damn local. That's going to be a really cool workshop. And I really want to remind you guys again, it's going to be mid-September. I have to look it up real quick here to give you an exact date. It's be Saturday, September 19 is when the tickets will go on sale. There'll probably be a blog post about it coming next week. And then a lot more information coming over the next couple of weeks. And it'll be third weekend of September. I always try to run it on September because it always weekend in September. Because it gives people plenty of time to make arrangements with travel and such by beginning of November. But it also, on a Saturday, gives people a chance that you're usually not working and you have a better chance to get in because it always sells out. On selling out, also a reminder, Tuesday, the AI course is going to go on sale. That's going to be Tuesday the 25th next week. You'll get one reminder now and one on Monday. And if you're on the list, Tom sends reminders about it as well. If you're on the list, if you're not on the list, you're not getting in. If you want to take our AI course for solopreneurs, it's fifth round, four rounds have sold out. I don't see why the fifth one won't. You want to get on that list. Right now we're at about a 7-to-1 ratio, about 7 people registered for every spot we have available. We have it set up kind of like Ticketmaster. It won't shut the server down or anything. Love to have you in that class. And remember, when you join the class, you not only get to take the class, you get to take it over and over again if you want to, and you get plugged into an alumni group, hundreds of people who are entrepreneurs, who are building businesses that want to work together, that can help you out, that have also had the training and are, you know, I think people learn as much as from each other as they do from Tom and I in the course. All right, with that, let's go ahead and get on with the final segment, which is going to be my – oh, yeah, West Virginia, though. West Virginia next week, right, next Saturday. Not the Saturday this weekend, Saturday next weekend. If you're near Charleston, I'm going to be in West Virginia giving the keynote speech and sitting on a discussion panel at the Home Educators Conference, and we have a meetup at my hotel, 6:30 to 9:30, if you want to come by that as well. All right, that's on the site as well. You can look that up. All right, let's talk about Bitcoin a little bit. I had a question come in. It wasn't really a question. It was a couple different people on different platforms said, maybe it's time for you to rehash why Bitcoin is a good investment despite all of the stuff that's been drummed up about paper Bitcoin, sue coiners, spam on the network, blah, 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 blah. And I again, I don't think this is a whole show. I think this is a 5-minute segment from this point forward here. So when I see the timer get to about 10 minutes, I need to stop. Bitcoin is what it's always been. We just went through this, you know, they call it a war, but I mean, if you were here for the block wars and through 2016, 2018, this is not a war. This is an annoying mosquito that can't sting the 110 crowd. And there's a lot of people saying that, hey, they went about it wrong, but they brought up some legitimate concerns. And one of those concerns is the spam thing. Okay. First of all, the spam thing does not affect whether or not Bitcoin is useful. So there's data on the network. So, I don't care. But it's not financial data. I don't care. We've always had that. We had that from the very beginning. Well, the block size is too big now. No, the block size is the same as it always was. Like, all the objections are irrelevant. They have no effect on reality. And you, but Bitcoin is captured because it didn't change. The fact that people that run nodes, 20% of them thought they could change the network. If that was possible, then Bitcoin is not defensible. Bitcoin worked exactly the way it was supposed to. To understand that whole dynamic, you have to understand one very simple thing. Bitcoin does not depend on honest actors at all. And Satoshi never, whoever he, she, they were, right, did not code it to depend on anybody's honesty. It was coded to depend on one thing only, self-interest of every individual, thereby acting as a collective whether they wanted to or not. And this is free market genius, all right? Have you ever heard the speech, I think it was Milton Friedman gave, about a pencil and how amazing it is that he's holding this pencil because of all of the people that had to work collectively to make the pencil, the people that made the graphite for what we call lead, but it's really graphite, the people that did the rubber, the little metal piece that the eraser goes into, and the wood. And it's not just that, because somebody had to cut the tree. The tree then probably was used for things other than pencils. Some spare piece of the tree, somebody had to see the opportunity to make the pencil. And then that had to move to a factory that milled it into the type of wood that you make a pencil from. And then the pencil had to go in a box with other pencils, so somebody had to make the box, and somebody had to print the box. But then the boxes had to go into a big box called a case. And then the case, like, it just goes through this whole thing, and then you don't even think about it, but by the time you get that pencil for 20 cents, thousands upon thousands of people, all acting in their own self-interest, contributed to the pencil. Okay? That's how Bitcoin works. The miners control Bitcoin. The miners do control Bitcoin to a majority degree. Now, if the rest of the network is unhappy, then the miners have to think about that, and then the rest of the network pulls the miners in another direction, which has also happened in the past. If you know your Bitcoin history, I won't go into it. It's too long. Right. So what I mean by that is when this whole war came up and the miners supposedly colluded and attacked, right, this bullshit narrative that Kratter and Luke Dash Jr. and whatever have come up with, what the miners collectively did was nothing. We didn't do anything. I'm a miner. I own ASICs. I mine with one of the big mining companies in one of the big mining pools. But I can literally, right now, while I'm talking, I could get on my laptop and change my pool I'm mining with. I could change what I'm mining. I could mine fucking Litecoin if I want to. I don't want to, but I could. Right? The whole nonsense of, like, it's captured, whatever. Why didn't I signal for 110 with my mining? Because in my own self-interest, I didn't want to mine worthless blocks. That's why. And thousands of people made that same decision or were blissfully unaware of the fact that there was even a fight. This is why you can trust Bitcoin. But there's monkey JPEGs or whatever. And you know what? I don't care. And that's why the protocol Knots, running that on your node, was perfect. Because what is the purpose of a node? Mining is for security of the network. That's what it does. All those machines all over the world, just worrying 24/7, they provide security to make sure people can't steal your Bitcoin, change the monetary governance, right, and to verify a transaction so that you know when somebody sends it to you, you really have it. That's what miners do. Miners provide security. Nodes provide individual sovereignty. And the original Knots, what that let you do is throw out what was in the OP return, which is the big stink in the first place. You just toss it out. Well, I don't want to have my node bloated. You didn't have to. You didn't have to. Now, hopefully somebody, because Luke has gone off into la-la land, will pick up Knots, keep it current and updated, or redo it in some way, or come up with some easy way for us to just filter op return. I'm betting Core actually will build that into one of the newer versions in a real BIP or something like that. In other words, that once you're running Core 30.1.35A5791 or whatever the fuck they call it, right, you'll be able to, like, think, okay, I just want to, like, click here to filter out op return off your node, because that's why they put the shit in there. Somehow this fight then pulled in all the grievances that these plebs who are like, I'm the OG Bitcoiner. Most of them have been here for like 3 to 5 years, and most of them own less than 0.1 Bitcoin. So they haven't fought the battles. They haven't hodled through the fucking real hell. They haven't been through Mt. Gox. They weren't through the block wars. They weren't here when Silk Road went down. They weren't here for all that shit, but they know better than everybody, right? They don't like a lot of things that they're seeing because Instafluencers have revved them up about Sailor's a suit coiner and this is not the way it's supposed to be and blah, 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 blah. You can hate those people, but what makes Bitcoin money? What makes Bitcoin money? Let's do that real quick and then we'll end this. And if I need to talk about it more on Monday, I will. And it's five key principles that make Bitcoin money that you can depend on and trust. Number one is the ability to self-custody to the point of running your own node and having a hardware wallet or even just having a really good soft wallet where you control your keys, you control your coins, and no one can take them from you. Okay? It can't be money if you can't custody it. How does that work with the United States dollar? If you hold your dollars in a bank account, you don't have self-custody. If you have paper bills in hand, you have self-custody. Okay? And so the dollar fails on some levels, but you can take it. Now, it has problems that Bitcoin doesn't. Like if you have $50,000 worth of cash, you can't really spend it in one place. No one will take it because money laundering, blah, 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 blah. But you can self-custody the physical cash. You can self-custody Bitcoin. This helps everybody, even people who don't self-custody. The fact that you can self-custody makes exchanges more honest than they would be if you could not, for instance, okay? And then if you can self-custody, you know you have point number two, which is direct peer transfer. For all of the subtards out there, read the white paper, it's a peer-to-peer cash system. And it is. But the fees or whatever. Okay, fine. That's part of playing the game. That's what you pay for premium currency. Right? And it's not that expensive. It's nonsense. Fees are lower than they've been historically almost ever. But the fact that you can transfer Bitcoin to me or I can transfer Bitcoin to you and we do not need a third party. That makes, without that, it's not money. It's a system of credit. Okay. Fixed 21 million supply. I believe gold is money and gold has a historic inflation rate of about 2%. So it doesn't have to be fixed, but what it has to be is contained. In other words, the physical laws of nature have made it where man, no matter how fast we dig, how deep we dig, how much technology, we can only increase the supply of gold by about 2% per annum. And so that's not inflation free, but it's inflation mitigated, right? Bitcoin's 21 million cap supply. And of course, the FUD coming out of the people that just fought their fake mosquito war right now are saying, well, if they can do that, then why can't they change to 21 million? Well, who tried to change it? You did and you failed. You actually just proved your own counter argument that like a small group of people can't just do it. What if all the miners try to do it? Well, see, now you, this is where the rest of the network comes in. That's when unholy hell would have been unleashed if you tried to do that. Well, so-and-so said something about a tail emission. It doesn't matter. Lots of people say lots of things. Until somebody that actually is trying to do something, you can stop listening to everything everybody says, right? But having that fixed 21 million, in other words, someone can't steal your money without stealing your money. That's what inflation is. Inflation is a hidden tax where the government steals your money by printing more money. When the government prints $1 billion because it needs it because it's Tuesday, where does the new $1 billion get its value? It sucks it from the old money. Inflation is not just the money supply increasing. You've been lied to about that. It is the money supply increasing at a rate faster than the growth of the economy, right? If the economy grows by exactly $1 billion and we have a new $1 billion come in any time frame, inflation is effectively zero. But when the economy, and I don't mean just in numbers, I mean in actual production. If the production value and the monetary value both go up by about $1 billion relative to the price of the currency before the increase, you have zero inflation. But what you really want, in spite of everything the economics teacher will tell you, is deflation. In other words, downward pressure on prices. And in an era of hard money, even with 2% inflation, you could have deflation. That's why, you know what Henry Ford's plan for the Model T was? And it was executed perfectly up until they really screwed the money supply. Like, even though we were still based on gold, like I'm talking 1930s, but all the way through the 1920s, do you know what Henry Ford was able to do? Build the same car a little bit better the next year for less money every year. That was the plan. And with hard money, it was doable. And as soon as you start effing with the money, you couldn't do it. So you have to have a fixed supply or at least a known quantitative resistance to inflation. Bitcoin has a fixed supply. It's done perfectly. Your voluntary consensus as part of enforcement. No one made people use gold for money. When somebody started putting their picture on money and using a bill and promising gold for it, then we had enforcement that was non-voluntary. In other words, how Bitcoin works is a voluntary consensus mechanism. But the miners just, no, 20% of node runners, not 20% of the network. Stop saying that. It's dumb. 20% of people who bought a cheap off-the-shelf box and plugged it in, many of whom never connected a wallet to it, thought they could change the network. That would not be voluntary consensus. 20% of any group changing things against the will of 80% is not voluntary consensus. The rules are known. The rules are simple. They're easy to understand if you want to. And the people who chose not to are crying about the rules. That would be voluntary consensus. And then permissionless use for all. This is the most important one. When people say, the Bitcoiners, BlackRock, don't tell your Bitcoin, shut up. The whole point of real money is anybody can do anything with it within the laws of science, physics, and reality. And there's nothing you can do about it, or it's not real money. So that doesn't mean that somebody can make more of it. That's alchemy, right? Well, they couldn't ever figure out how to turn lead into gold, so they created fiat currency. That's a different type of, it's technological alchemy, right? But once you have gold, I can't tell you what to do with your gold. You can bury it in a hole in the ground. You can buy a giant building and start making some other shit with it. You can put it in a vault. You could chop it up in little pieces. You can melt it into earrings. I'm sure there's people that think earrings are a non-monetary use of gold. Doesn't matter. Anybody can do anything they want with it. So can somebody take a big piece of that, purchase it with fiat bucks, and leverage it against fiat's inflation by holding against it a deflationary asset like Bitcoin? Yes. That's your strike, your stride, et cetera, within Master. Can a company acquire it by selling things, including their own stock, and put it on their balance sheet and hold it there even if you don't like it? Yes. And if they couldn't do that, if somebody could say, I don't like that, so they can't do that, then it's not money. It's a credit system, and whoever manages the credit system controls who does what with it. So within the bounds of legality, and that's even in question, right? Because plenty of people have done things that are considered illegal with Bitcoin and gotten away with it, right? But with, you know, public-facing institutions anyway, within the balance of legality and physics and reality, can do anything they want with money, and you don't get to do anything, and that's a good thing. The fact that people try to change this, try to use FUD, try to do all these things, and Bitcoin just tick-tock next block every 10 minutes, baby, it doesn't matter. But paper Bitcoin, stop using that term. You're using a term in ignorance because somebody taught it to you. IBIT and things like that are not paper Bitcoin in that there is Bitcoin on the other side of it, because unlike gold and silver, so GLD, SLV, these are ETFs for silver and gold, you can't audit them. They say, trust me, bro. We have a contract leveraging into contract leveraging into contract so we can maintain this. Okay, whatever. Fine for trading, but you better not try to hold it long term. When you look at BlackRock, they have to publicly report, this is how many customers we have, this is how many shares, this is the value of shares, this is the net equivalent Bitcoin necessary, here's our addresses. It's in their charter. We know these addresses. I have a tool built on something called Dune. You can look it up at any time you want to, and you can see how many people hold it, and you can see all the Bitcoin on their public addresses. That's one of the good things about Bitcoin not being Monero. The fact that it is auditable is the only way it could be used by anybody as money. I don't like not having the privacy option personally, but I understand the trade-off. So don't worry about suit coiners. Don't worry about paper Bitcoin. Don't worry about spam. Don't worry about any of it. TikTok next block. Stay humble, stack sats, and you are in the accumulation trough right now for Bitcoin. And if you're resistant to this now, all I'll say is you're poorer for having not listened to me talk about doing this since 2012. And if you're bitter about that, don't blame me. Don't even blame yourself. Just realize right now you can set up a daily DCA with a company like Strike. You can buy a dollar a day, $5 a day, $10 a day, whatever you think is right. And you can end every day with more sats than you started with. And that is the simple way to wealth with Bitcoin. And most people that get themselves in trouble, and I would be far wealthier myself if I had figured that out all the way back in 2012. We think we need to do things. We're going to find this altcoin. We're going to trade it. We're going to buy it high and sell it low and low high. Buy it low and sell it high or whatever. No. Stack, shut up, be humble. Bitcoin will humble you in time. I was humbled by a shotgun that I bought in 2014 for $600 when Bitcoin was at about $600. If you'd like to see a $70,000 shotgun, I can show you one. It's a really nice shotgun. It was a good deal when I bought it. I paid a third of what it was worth. I'm sure the person I gave the Bitcoin to pissed it away. I'm sure of it. It's okay. It doesn't matter. But I learned from that experience, and I've tried to teach from experience versus teach from listening to other people and repeating their bullshit. With that, let's go ahead and wrap up. Thank you guys for tuning in today. Remember, come meet me in West Virginia next Saturday. If you can do that, that would be great. Pick up copies of my books, Laws of Life, Book 1 and Book 2 on Amazon. Consider becoming a member of the MSB. Send me your questions for shows like this for the expert panel. Send me your requests for topics. And, hey, we got Monday Mayhem going now. This is where it's all high energy, old school style TSP, multiple topics. We blast through them real fast. We finished in like 47 minutes last Monday. It was great. Hey, if you have something you want me to riff on in a Monday Mayhem, send me an email. Any email to me, TSPC in the subject line, we'll make sure I see it. Question or content, your point, one sentence. Hit the return key a couple times and give me all the details you want. I'll try to get to them all. I won't, but I'll try. But I will tell you this. TSPC goes in the subject of the email to me. I will see it 99.9% of the time. There's always a potential I miss something. I'm human. But I tried to this day, after 18 years, at least scan every email that comes in and take it into consideration, even if I don't reply or put it on the air. With that, take care. Have a great weekend. I will catch you on Monday with Monday.
Just run you round. They said you should have a house the American way. Dollar down, a dollar a month, and you'll never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.